Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to A Deeper Look here on KBOO. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund, and my topic today is the human cost of the war in Afghanistan. My guest is peace activist Kathy Kelly. She's a founder of the organization Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and she's actually a lifelong activist for peace. She's a three-time nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize and has made over 25 visits to Iraq, meeting and working with the victims of our foreign policy. Since 2009, she's made trips to Pakistan and Afghanistan, and her last to Afghanistan was in November, just this past November. Just one moment. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Kathy. Sorry about that cough.
Oh, thank you, Linda. It's a privilege to be on your show.
I know you're over in Colorado Springs talking to a college or working with a college class.
There's a nonviolence retreat that happens every year for students who sign up for a nonviolence class, and they're very hospitable, so it's been great to be here with them and to listen from their perspective to how they might see the possibility of what's being accomplished in Tahrir Square in Egypt or in Bahrain or Tunisia. Have an effect here in the United States as well.
Well, we're certainly seeing that in Wisconsin, and so a very important work that you're doing there. But we're going to talk to you today about an article that was published in Common Dreams that you wrote just a few days ago, actually about a week ago. And on March 1st, there was a U.S. helicopter attack that killed 9 Afghan boys. These were children out gathering wood, and you wrote the article titled "The Cost of U.S. Terrorism in Afghanistan, Incalculable." So let's go ahead and begin talking right there about that attack and what happened and the results of it.
Well, it's very typical for families in Afghanistan, particularly the poorest of families, to send their children out to the mountainsides in spite of danger to go and collect scrub brush and twigs and small logs, so that they can have fuel. That's how they cook their food over open fires, and that's what is used to heat homes. So it's something that children do as a responsibility to their family. And 9 youngsters, actually 10, were out on the mountainside in the Pech Valley in the Kunar province. And one youngster survived the attack. And so in his eyewitness account, he said that they had just about finished collecting all of their wood, and a helicopter swooped down quite low, and he said he saw a green flash, and a tree fell on him when the firing started, and so he was spared. But watching what had happened, he saw each of the youngsters gunned down one by one by the helicopter. And this isn't an isolated incident. In the same valley, the same province, on August 26th, 6 youngsters were on a mountainside, and they were collecting scrap metal, again, to help their families, and they were gunned down. And it certainly raises the question, if the United States is supposed to be having so much sophisticated surveillance, and General Petraeus has said that he wants to be constantly fed information, why is it that U.S. pilots and gunners can't distinguish between insurgents and children? The children were aged between 15 years of age and 9 years of age. And I think it certainly is something that requires investigation, and it's interesting that General Petraeus apologized the very next day, and that is not in keeping with the pattern in which quite often when these atrocities have happened, the United States denies or underestimates the number of casualties or says, well, these were definitely insurgents. And then maybe 2 months later, if anybody happens to be keeping up with the accounts, you might finally get an apology issued and an acknowledgement.
And but sometimes they even give money to the families, don't they?
Well, yes, they do. They give compensation money. Also, something I think that's important in this regard is that previously, a week previous, there had been 65 people killed, and the United States was claiming that only 7 of them were civilians and that the others were insurgents. But President Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan had done an official investigation. He was very, very angered, and of course the Afghan public opinion is filled with rage over these killings. And the Afghan government says, no, these were 65 civilians. And some people said, well, what about the children who survived but whose bodies were burned, badly burned? And General Petraeus said, well, that's how Afghan parents sometimes discipline their children. Maybe they burned those children themselves.
Oh, my God. He actually said that. That's truly shocking. That's worse than culturally insensitive.
Yeah. So can you imagine the reaction of the parents and the who were dizzied? I mean, they just couldn't believe what they were hearing. So maybe the opprobrium that resulted from that horrific statement is part of what occasioned kind of an immediate apology after the deaths of the children on March 1st in Kunar. But apologies aren't enough. We have to ask, are the policies going to be changed? You know,
let me stop you for a second there, Kathy. I want to go back to the kids and the families because I want to make this as real for all of us out here who are parents and have children or who are young people and remember our brothers and sisters, can think of our nieces, to really get a picture of this. So we're on a remote mountain and we're in Afghanistan, and you've visited there. You've seen in the similar areas and you've seen how people lived. I understand that one of the boys that was killed, his father had died from a long illness, and he had two mothers and 13 sisters. He's the only male of the family, and he was providing all of the support for the family. So can you tell us, make it real for us, the conditions there that these people are living in, that somehow this helicopter can swoop down and kill them?
Well, in provinces all across Afghanistan, people have very limited access to electricity. The province that I visited, called Bamyan, is a place where people get 2 hours of electricity per day between the hours of 1 and 3 in the morning. Well, you know, everybody's asleep then. So they really rely on their children. One young boy I know, his name is Zekarullah, and he says he might be 15, he might be 16, he's not sure because nobody really counts the birthdays the way we do. But he gets up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and this would be at least once or twice a week. All throughout the year, he'll get on his donkey and ride 6 hours to go out to the mountainside, scavenge for wood and twigs and fuel, load that onto baskets on the donkey, and then ride 6 hours back. And then they stack the wood up on the roof of their mud hut, and that's what the family relies on for fuel. And this is very typical. Now, I think we should be asking right away, well, how can it be that the United States has been an occupying force in Afghanistan since 2001 when we invaded, and they still don't have any electricity?
And the billions and billions of dollars, and I believe there was something like $900 million that got spotted, according to WikiLeaks, by U.S. officials being transferred out of the country by Karzai's brother. There's more money than any of us can actually imagine flowing in and through that country.
Well, and then I think we should keep in mind $2 billion per week being spent on our soldiers and our occupation, $2 billion a week. And you might start to wonder, well, wait a minute, how can they possibly spend such a high amount of money? But even if you, well, maybe I can just say that I've been in Colorado Springs in preparation to go out to this nonviolence course with the students here. And they've been telling me that in Colorado Springs, people are really gearing up for a huge construction project. The United States Air Force wants 150 more helicopters. These are helicopter gunships. The engines inside of them are equivalent to the ones that they put into an M1 Abrams tank. And these things are incredible pollutants of the environment, and they guzzle enormous amounts of gasoline. And they want 150 more U.S. helicopter gunships to be able to patrol the skies of Afghanistan and possibly gun down innocent civilians.
Boys like this. And then we see, I wanted to go back to that scene in Afghanistan, because when they're out there gathering the wood, we do know, we've seen the film footage, WikiLeaks has leaked it, we do know that from those helicopters, they really can get a good view of whether these are small people, big people, whether they have even things in their hands or not, what they're moving. And I know that so the people in the area of that particular base have been actually kind of unhappy about having the base there, and that base was preparing to move soon, I believe, because of the at least in part because of the unrest of the people there. They just wanted them gone and to go on and live their lives. Now, these people are not necessarily in any way participating in warfare other than just trying to stay alive. Is that accurate?
Well, this is what makes it all the more inscrutable. What would possibly have been the motive for the killing of these children on the mountainside? But I think that something that's tangential to this is happening right now in Washington State. A striker brigade was on trial.
Yes.
A military tribunal met because they were accused of going on an actual killing spree, of deliberately killing civilians and then storing the body parts of the that they would cut off of the corpses as war trophies. And one of the men who was part of this group being investigated was found guilty for having been involved in this, in the storing of the body parts. And his punishment is that for 2 months he has to do supervised chores on the base. Now,
that's just
I don't think that
comprehensible, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that we should say that punishing one individual is going to solve problems, but it seems that there's a signal being sent that this is a very minor infraction, that this young person was involved in this, and we remain unsure what the final resolution of this investigation will be. But this I can tell you, certainly, young people that I knew that I met with in October of 2010 were very aware of this case, Bamiyan University students. In fact, one of the university students had asked me, do Americans care more about noses than fingers? And what he was referring to was the Time magazine cover story of the young woman, Aisha, whose nose had been mutilated maybe by men in her own family who wanted to punish her because they said she violated sexual mores in their culture. And this was a brutal and a gruesome thing that was done to this young woman. But on Time magazine, the headline said, "Why Troops Must Stay in Afghanistan."
Yes, and I believe Time was working directly with our government in an attempt to get feminist sentiments on the side of staying in Afghanistan.
So the student asked me, do Americans care more about noses than fingers? Because
yes,
he was very aware in October of 2010 about a case which I think most U.S. people don't hear about because Time magazine isn't putting that on the cover of the magazine. Time magazine isn't looking at the justifiable outrage being felt by Afghan civilians who believe that their invaders and occupiers are going to determine their future and that they don't get much say-so while a very corrupt government is being kept alive by the United States support.
And those outraged Afghanis have taken up in protest. I believe there was a protest in the nearest village to where these boys came from, and that there's also a protest of hundreds in Kabul when Petraeus was meeting with Karzai and others in the security committee meeting where he talked about it. And that's a very bold step. And those protests said that they wanted both the Taliban and the United States out of Afghanistan. In your travels in that area, is that the feeling you get from most people, is that they'd like to have the United States actually leave as soon as possible?
Well, I spent all of most of December and part of early January in Afghanistan as a guest of a group of people called the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers. And they had come to Kabul particularly intent on being able to interview people who had created a very reliable report called Nowhere to Turn. And I say reliable because they were 29 non-governmental organizations who've been working in Afghanistan with a long history of and a good reputation of having tried to accomplish needed human services and analysis in Afghanistan. And they had all signed on to a report challenging the United States military version of what's happening and saying that the proposed solution of forming militias in every town all across Afghanistan and giving people uniforms and weapons to be kind of a...
to become targets.
that this wasn't a good idea. And then they challenged the United States to stop using death squads and assassinations and night raids because it was creating so much antagonism and maybe even creating more support for the armed opposition groups. And it's a report that should be read. And so these
say the name
people,
of that report again.
The Nowhere to Turn report. And it was delivered in mid-November at a time when the people who signed on to it, and Oxfam, which authored the report, thought, well, this will certainly be looked at because NATO is gathering in mid-November of 2010, and this is going to be a time when the world will be focused and they'll really want to hear this alternative dissenting point of view. Well, there was no press coverage whatsoever for it, I don't think. So these youngsters wrote their own December review as a kind of a parallel to what the Obama administration was putting forth, because the Obama administration was claiming progress in Afghanistan. And they said, look, you know, the UN has said this is the worst country in the world into which a child can be born, and 850 children die every single day, and one out of every five children never makes it past their fifth birthday, and the average life expectancy is 44 years old. What do you mean progress? And they carefully talked over their experiences with people who have been part of this Nowhere to Turn report. And I think that it's certainly you can't say there's any one person that's speaking for all of Afghanistan. But there is one person who has run for presidential election and came in third. His name is Dr. Ramadan Bashar Dost. And he right now is a member of parliament. He has resigned from being the Minister of Planning of Afghanistan because of corruption. He previously resigned a member of parliament post again because of corruption, but he keeps on being reelected. And he's somebody who believes strongly that the corruption is so riddled throughout the current governance, that the ministries are owned by military warlords that were people whose hands are so bloodstained and who've engaged in so much corruption and control of the drug trade, and that you kind of have to start from a clean slate. And he had felt very, very sad when President Obama called President Hamid Karzai and congratulated him upon being elected president of Afghanistan, because he said it was a fraudulent election and that these kinds of widespread cases of fraud shouldn't be endorsed by other people from other parts of the world. So I think there is a sense in Afghanistan that they'd be better off if they were left alone rather than having an occupying force determining their future.
And that's even those who do not support the Taliban. There are certainly many who do not want the former Taliban regime to come into power again with all of its extreme controls over women and corruption. It was really a very bad regime. But certainly U.S. invasion has not proven to be better. Now, when you're visiting people there, you talked about the youth there, and I know they've formed a variety of organizations to work towards peace. When you're there, I sometimes see Afghanistan as almost hopeless, and I'm sorry to say this openly, but it's true, because they're surrounded by so many politics within that region, and everybody wants a piece of or wants to control that area. We are also attempting to control Pakistan. When you look at the situation as it is in there, what do you see realistically is the future of the United States? What is it attempting to do there? Is it simply to control that whole area and have us forget that there are real people there suffering as a result? Because it seems to me that the Afghani people are almost an aside for the American policy.
Well, I think that, again, going back to that NATO conference in mid-November of 2010, that was the first time when the Asia Development Bank said, okay, count us in, we will bankroll the construction of the TAPI pipeline. This is a pipeline that would transport fossil fuels and natural gas through Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. So that's why it's called TAPI, the acronym for those four countries. And this is something I think the United States very much wants. The United States wants to control the pricing and the flow of precious energy resources in a country adjacent to China. And I think also the United States is very aware that Pakistan is the only Muslim country which possesses the nuclear bomb. The United States is aware that Afghanistan shares a border with Iran, as do Pakistan. Pakistan and Iran also share a border. So geopolitically, with Afghanistan is situated near Russia, China, Iran, and Pakistan, the United States wants bases and roadways connecting those bases all across that country so that we can squeeze those other countries and also have an economic advantage if China has to pay more for its access to energy reserves than perhaps we'd be paying. So these are all considerations
and you do hear our
nothing to do with average ordinary people on the ground who can't get clean water, who have a wretched education system, who don't get health care delivery, and whose children are out doing hard labor at age five.
And they only occasionally do pretenses of look of how we're helping the people of Afghanistan. They'll show us building a school that we find out 2 months later got bombed or never got occupied or can't operate because there's only the 2 hours of electricity, et cetera. But even that, mostly they don't. And I'm from back in the Vietnam War time, and I think you also were around during that time. And I remember getting to see, I say this not with ease, but seeing the pictures of those we were killing, those we were burning with napalm. And I think it's been talked about quite a bit in the anti-war movement that this time the media has been successful along with the United States government in keeping those images from us. How much role do you think it plays that we aren't seeing the people of Afghanistan as this is happening to them?
Well, I think that we have to take some of that responsibility on ourselves, Linda. We've got mm-hmm. access now to the internet, and we can be much more aware. We don't have to let our awareness of world events be conditioned only by what's filtered through major mainstream news outlets. Or, you know, I have to say, in fairness, that Voices for Creative Nonviolence has been keeping an Afghan atrocities list where we list every time
we learn
about an attack by the United States forces against unarmed civilians. Well, really, we learn about it through the New York Times and through mainstream groupings that they mention it, but they only mention it as a sentence, and then it's gone. You know, you turn the page, and the same thing happens a week later, and it doesn't seem like news because it just happened last week. There's no slowing down, paying attention, recognizing the pain that's been caused. We don't hear from the bereaved people. We don't find out any follow-up to these atrocities that are reported and then just let evaporate. So we have to say, no, that's unacceptable. We want to know more. We want to find out more. And that's why a number of us in our travel in mid-March over to Afghanistan are going to be part of what we're calling a global day of listening. And we've experimented with this about four times now in the past. And what it involves is people calling in to hear from youngsters, this time from both Afghanistan and Iraq and possibly from Gaza as well. And people with translation can hear from the young people themselves. What are they experiencing? What's their point of view? What are their major cares and concerns? So I really encourage your listeners to think about that. You can just go to, even write globaldayoflistening at gmail.com and sign up for a slot to between March 20th and 21st. And we'll have 26 people from the United States joining with a few internationals from other countries with the young people who are planning to hold an inter-ethnic march, a very brave thing to do, through the streets of Kabul. And then that'll be followed by a tree planting and also a candlelight vigil in memory of the young people who died on that mountainside in Kunar.
Well, this sounds like a really, really important day. I'm glad to hear about it. You know, I do believe that the peace movement is beginning to be revived here. I know that here in Portland, Oregon, on March 19th, and it's been talked about a lot on this station, but it should be talked about as much as we need to make sure that everybody who can gets out there. On March 19th at 12:30 in Pioneer Courthouse Square, there will be a, I hope, large rally and protest march for peace and against the wars, and it will start at 12:30 that day, and it is sponsored by a really large array of different organizations, which should bring us out more people, and I think that's so important. Your event will follow the day after. That's perfect. People will be right in the mood to call in and hear real Afghanis talk about it. I know that some of the most important events I attended in wars in the past were when, for example, women from North Vietnam came and talked to women here about what was happening in their nation. It brings it home to us. We as people sort of need that people-to-people connection. So I really thank you. Can you state that day again for our listeners and what they would do?
Sure. You can write to globaldayoflistening@gmail.com and say that you'd like to take a slot in a phone conversation. All you need is a telephone between March 20th to 21st. Or go to livewithoutwars.org.
Which is the organization these young people have formed, right, called right. livewithoutwars.com.
Dot org.
Yes, dot org, exactly. Very important kinds of activities. I'm speaking with Kathy Kelly, a lifelong peace activist, three-time Nobel Peace Prize Award nominee. Kathy, you are going there in March. It's partly to arrange this. If there are people who want to be part of a more hands-on experience with resisting the war and creating ways of bringing about peace, are there ways that people can become part of those kinds of events that you're talking about, traveling to countries like Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Well, I think that travel is certainly one way. It's a bit risky, and so we...
Talk about the travel that you guys do and how you do it.
Well, it's also very expensive, and so we didn't put out a widespread call for people to... apply to join us. We actually put out the word to people we knew had been in war zones before and had some experience of how they might
respond. It's very important.
Under situations of very high stress. And one of the reasons it's expensive, besides the airfare, to be in Afghanistan is because it's almost like a one big prison in Kabul. There are so many fortified buildings and armed guards in front of the buildings, and you can't find an inexpensive place to stay because the hotels and guest houses pay quite a lot for security, even though I don't know that if somebody had a strong intent to destroy one of those places, that the security people posted outside would make very much of a difference. But you can't just hail a taxi. You pretty well have to rely on a much more expensive car company to take a ride someplace. So it's a place where you don't see Westerners out on the streets very often. But I think that it is important that we begin to build relationships, as you said, with people who've meant us no harm but who are bearing the brunt of the war, and to better understand. I mean, you get the point in Kabul pretty quickly that the electricity is so sporadic that the lights are going out in the evening once an hour, and then maybe the building you're in has a backup generator, but maybe not. Well, it's very hard for anybody to keep any sort of industry going, or certainly it's extremely difficult to accomplish basic communication. People feel isolated and frustrated. And I think especially in the more remote rural areas where there's only 2 hours of electricity between the hours of 1 and 3 in the morning, or where people don't have roadways and they are still relying on going up and down hills with donkeys in order to transport needed goods. It's a very hard life that people experience, and they want to be able to feed their families, and they don't want their children to get gastrointestinal diseases because of dirty water, which then combined with malnutrition make it so hard for the children to survive. They don't want to be going to cemeteries burying the bodies of their children who can't make it beyond the age of 5. And it's important for us to see that this is the country that we're pounding every single day. And then when you look, for instance, at the people that are displaced because then they had to flee even their humble homes because they were bombed because there was some suspicion that there might have been a Taliban person in their neighborhood, and they're in wretched refugee camps, and you look on the road and there are trucks constantly streaming into the big, huge military base just across the road. This is the case right across from the Chhar-e-Khambar refugee camp in Kabul, where there are 1,000 families that have had to flee from the wars, and they're living under absolutely squalid, horrendous conditions. I mean, I was sitting next to a little girl whose arm had been cut off in a drone attack, and you could see that she was hungry, that she hasn't gotten proper medical care. And you look across the road, and there, for miles, there's a huge United States base that's been built, and the trucks bring water and food and supplies.
It's a shocking contradiction, isn't it, to see the contrast between the two. And I've been speaking with Kathy Kelly, peace activist, and we're going to have to leave it right there, Kathy. And I think it's a good place to leave it, because if you need a reason to get out and become part of the protest on March 19th, I think you've just heard it. If you're not able to protest, there are so many other ways that you can take action on behalf of the people of Afghanistan. And I think that my audience knows most of those. So thank you very much for joining us today, Kathy Kelly, and thank you for doing the hard and important work that you're doing.
Well, thank you, Linda, and please let's make sure that we're all in touch with the people who go to Congress and make these decisions and the ones that are bankrolling the next 150 helicopters that will be created here in Colorado. Let's make sure that we let them know what our priorities are. And
where we'd rather see that money go. Thank you very much. This has been Linda Olson Osterlund for A Deeper Look. I'll put this, post the audio from this show up onto the web, and you can see it there under A Deeper Look, KBOO/A Deeper Look. Thank you very much for listening.